Welcome to the Pardes Parsha podcast. My name is Zvi Hirschfield, and I have the distinct privilege and pleasure of discussing the profound analysis and deep insights into the Parsha from my wonderful colleagues at the Pardes Institute. So glad you could join us. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another, what I hope will be an exciting podcast on Parshat Tazria. I am blessed and overjoyed to have my friend, colleague, and teacher, Rabbi Michael Hatton, teacher, author, extraordinaire, neighbor, all those wonderful things. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Zvi. Pleasure to be here.
And I think you've almost been on here enough to qualify for the big lottery we're going to do at the end. No, we don't have a lottery. I'm making that up. There is no lottery. We're just glad that you're here to share some Torah with us. So here we are, and I feel like we are now in the Parshiot in Sefer Vayikra, where a lot of us as moderns do a lot of head scratching, right? We're not a narrative, but the laws that we are getting, and particularly this week with laws about purity and impurity and the mitzorah, or sometimes translated as the leper, but it's not leprosy. And I know that modern readers, you know, they hit this point, they probably bring something else to read if they're going to be a Torah reading in synagogue. So I think maybe we should sort of start out broadly. What is a modern brilliant scholar like yourself, but someone who also looks for relevance and meaning, what do you do when you encounter these laws of ritual purity and impurity?
It's a great question, Zvi. It's a broader question, too, about relevance in general, a material that we're reading that may strike us as atavistic or primitive or irrelevant. And I think as careful readers of the Torah, we are always seeking relevance and meaning, and that's part of what we do. That's part of our mandate, and that's part of what the enterprise of text study at Pardes is about as well. For me, when I think about Tumah and Tahara, I'm not thinking about clean or unclean. That's more of a hygienic description. I'm not thinking about pure and impure. I like to translate it as ritually fit and ritually unfit. And what I mean by that is it pertains particularly to one area that's no longer relevant for the most part, and that is the confines of the temple.
So it's interesting. Just want to begin with that. We know that in subsequent, especially in medieval literature and in Kabbalah and things, impurity took on this association with evil, the dark side, the wrong side. But you're saying when you read these parts of Tanakh, you're not reading a code of, oh, you're impure, you're bad. What you are reading are more technical descriptions that relate to the specific issue of entering the Mishkan, entering the Midash, and things associated with that.
Primarily, I mean, I think there sometimes can be a value judgment associated with it. There are certain sacrifices, certain korbanot that also render a person tameh, and those tend to be associated with sin. Certainly in the later prophets, we find that kind of overlap a lot where tameh becomes associated with ethical or moral failure. But I think in the parshiot that we're reading, it's more about biological function and the human condition, and that's what I want to explore.
So help us understand what you do with these categories from that perspective.
So I would begin by noting that I think a good argument could be made that every kind of tumah under the sun has a death component associated with it. I mean, the most obvious is, of course, the human corpse, which is the greatest generator of tumah, but there's also various kinds of animals or reptiles or even states that we're in sometimes, mostly associated with the malfunction of the reproductive organs for a man or a woman, that are going to generate tumah. And for me, therefore, tumah is about a state of death, whether it's physical death, whether it's the death of potential, and perhaps a little later on we can explore spiritual death as well.
So, broadly speaking, whenever we encounter in a physical way death, what you're suggesting is somehow that encounter, as natural as it might be, it's going to happen, right? For all the things that you mentioned, whether it's the states that our bodies reach in the most natural ways possible, and the need to bury a dead body, which unfortunately is going to be part of the human experience, that it's not that that's bad, but this encounter with death has somehow rendered you unfit in a spiritual way to encounter God in God's house.
Inasmuch as God is the source of life, inasmuch as the Mikdash or the temple is the locus of that encounter, so we are temporarily rendered unfit to actually enter the precincts of the temple. That's the idea. And this week's Parsha begins with sort of a curious form of this particular phenomenon, which is the woman who gives birth. That the woman who gives birth actually is also in the category of a person who becomes tamei during that process.
It sounds strange only because that would seem to be the most life-affirming moment of all. So how do you sort of put that together, this impurity as a result of giving birth?
So counterintuitive to be sure. I think for the woman, it's actually a loss of potential. The potential that she was bearing within her, that was growing within her, has been released to the world. That's the new baby. And for the woman, sort of that potential that was part of what she had been doing for 9 months is now dissipated. So believe it or not, with the loss of that potential life, which has turned into real life, insofar as her state is concerned, now she enters a temporary state of tuma.
She was a being of two souls in a way.
Yes.
And now she's a being of one soul.
And perhaps that would even explain why it is that when she gives birth to a girl, to a female child, the amount of tuma is doubled, because the girl herself is a generator of life in the future, a carrier of life. So it's almost like a double measure of life has been released from the woman, and that's effectively what creates this double level of tuma, or this double amount of tuma.
And so this encounter then not only renders us unfit, but in certain cases, one who is tamei can render other people or other objects unfit. It's almost like that we're looking to disassociate with the encounter, with anything resonant of death, and keeping that as far away as we can from our encounter with God, at least in God's house.
Listen, I think our tradition in general, we acknowledge the reality of the human condition, but we aspire to life. That's our tradition in many, many places. And I think this is a graphic and overwhelming expression of that fixation on life that's part and parcel of our faith.
So, Michael, as you know better than I, impurity can also adhere to objects, which I think is also this element of what? Like, what does that mean? You have a jar, and that jar was in contact with a dead body. You know, I think for a lot of people who read things like that, it evokes this both mystical and almost bizarre, like hidden energies being translated. But I know that you have a different take that brings us back to something more concrete and maybe even more relevant.
So I want to begin by just stressing that, you know, this discussion is theoretical, because in the absence of a temple, we don't really observe any of these laws whatsoever. But given that, as you note, Zvi, one of your favorite tractates in the Mishnah is the tractate Kelim.
All 30-some-odd chapters of it, folks.
Very long, very
gripping.
Large. Yes, and sort of that section of the Mishnah, Taharot, is the largest section in the Mishnah. So obviously, there's a lot to talk about. I'm going to be reductionist about it and suggest that we can, broadly speaking, break down any kind of vessel into certain materials. Vessels made out of stone will never become tamei, no matter what comes in contact with them. Other vessels, like those made out of wood, will become tamei, but only when they have a volume associated with them. If it's just a flat surface, a wooden vessel never becomes tamei. Torahitically, a tabletop will never become tamei if it's made out of wood. Other vessels, like metal, they will become tamei, even in the form of a flat surface. And it all seems very mysterious, and maybe most mysterious of all is the earthenware vessel, which can become tamei only when something tamei is suspended in its airspace, but not when something tamei touches its outside surface. And it all seems very mysterious and strange, and I suppose it is. I think for the ancients, this would have been as natural as the laws of kashrut for us. They would have, you know, immediately known what to do and how to do it. And for us, it's completely arcane. At the same time, if we think about those materials for a second and sort of our role as human beings in shaping them or transforming them, I think there's a progression here, which is to say that I can create a stone vessel, but I do not transform the stone material in that process. I shape it, but the stone material remains as inert as it was. If I'm talking about working with wood, then the amount of processing that I have to do as a human being to the basic material increases. You can't just make a vessel from a tree that you cut down and immediately make a vessel. You've got to dry out the wood, and you've got to do all sorts of other processes that will make that wood fit for work. If I'm talking about metal, it's even more pronounced. There's no natural metals in nature for the most part. You have to mine the ore, and you have to extract the metal at very high temperature. And there's an awful lot of investment of human potential in the process. I guess what I'm saying is, the greater the investment of human potential and the more obvious that investment is, the greater the susceptibility to tum'ah, which is another way of saying that tum'ah and tahara are really expressions of what we are as human beings.
A vessel that a person has had to work on much more and invest their energy and time and effort into, why are you saying that would increase its susceptibility to impurity?
Because tum'ah and tahara are expressions of human potential. In the same way that the greatest generator of tum'ah is the human corpse. That's a potential which has been exhausted. But it's the greatest potential which has been exhausted. That's the invitation for tum'ah to enter the picture. So really what I'm saying is, whatever the form of tum'ah or tahara that we're talking about, in some sort of a meta understanding of it, it's all related to our potential as human beings and the impact that we can have on the world.
In a way, maybe like the woman giving birth, when you finally complete the vessel, the potential is now gone.
Beautiful. And so that invites tum'ah, again, not as some sort of a value judgment. Nobody has done anything wrong. It's just a statement of what it is to be human and to have that impact on the world.
An awareness of our humanness, I guess, moving this forward, can sometimes limit our approach to godliness.
Limit and also increase. Because once we're aware of our potential as human beings, then that, of course, sort of defines us and the work that we do in the world in a very particular way. It has incredible meaning and importance that perhaps otherwise it doesn't have.
So from that perspective, the value of being tamei is the aspiration to then make oneself tahor. It gives you an opportunity to grow or move or become aware, and in that state, then go and be in the mikdash.
Correct. So even if I'm not actually in a state of tahara, there's no mitzvah to be in a state of tahara, except, you know, when I'm making my way to the temple, you know, during the festivals, whatever, there's no mitzvah to be tahor, but it's an awareness. It's an awareness of my potential as a human being and my potential impact as a human being on the world and how my aspiration is ultimately one that's life affirming.
So this is great. So now all of you can make it through at least the opening of this parsha, many other chapters in Leviticus, but let's move ahead to another puzzle. Let's see if we can take this model that you're offering and think through the laws related to tzara, to the mitzorah, right? And I don't know, do people translate it as leprosy anymore?
All the time.
They do, but in your mind, we'll just use the word mitzorah because it's not clear. Again, it's this example of this. It's not, I was going to say skin condition, but as we know, it can adhere to fabrics, it can adhere to stone houses. So when you look at that, again, like it's an invitation to say, look how primitive, look how bizarre, look how strange, or in best case scenario, look how ill-equipped our ancestors were at dealing with natural phenomena of mold or other skin problems and the need to find some mystical, profound significance, when in fact, we're just looking at a normal natural phenomena.
I mean, I'll go a step further and I'll say, you know, the amount of verses that the Torah devotes to this condition and to emerging from this condition is vast. It seems to be completely out of proportion to, you know, how often this happens. Certainly, we don't hear about it at all today. So we have a temptation to look at these sections in the Torah and to say they have absolutely nothing to teach me. So I want to push back on that and suggest that long ago, the rabbis already were busy working on reading this material in a way that would be not only relevant, but gripping.
Gripping, you say?
Gripping.
Okay, you set a high standard, my friend. Go ahead.
Okay, so there is one feature of the mitzorah which is different than any other form of tum'ah, and that is the mitzorah is sent forth from the camp. The encampment of the Israelites. The rabbis understand that the idea of tahara is hierarchical. Some spaces have more tahara and some spaces have less. And whatever the level of tuma, it will impact on what spaces I can access. So for instance, if I am in contact with a corpse, I'm excluded from the precincts of the temple called Machane Shechina. But I can enter other areas that have less holiness. On the other hand, if I am a zav or a zava, which means, again, some sort of issue from the reproductive organs, I can't even enter the precincts of the temple, the Machane Leviyah. But I can certainly remain within the camp of the Israelites. If I have tzara'at, I am completely distanced from the camp of the Israelites. Badad yeshev michutz lamachane moshavo. I have to dwell outside the camp until such a time as healing takes place. I think the rabbis were very, very interested in that particular feature, and they made one more incredible connection, really a pivotal one, that redefined the entire discussion for them. And that's the story of Miriam. Not in this week's Parsha, but in Parshat Bahalotcha. Miriam speaks ill of her brother Moshe, and Aharon seems to be, you know, on the bandwagon as well. And as a result of that, she is stricken with tzara'at, and she's driven out of the camp for a seven-day period. It's not that different than what our Parsha talks about in terms of being excluded from the camp for seven-day increments, depending on the condition. And the rabbis connected the dots, and they said, Miriam spoke ill of her brother. We call that Lashon Hara, disparaging remarks about another person, and that's why she is stricken with tzara'at, and that's why she is driven out of the camp until such time as she is ready to re-engage with people in a constructive way.
So tzara'at is no longer a bizarre, inexplicable condition, but you're saying Chazal, the sages, are understanding it as a sign that this person is unfit to be in the camp because of Lashon Hara, because of the way they speak.
Correct. Now, they sort of are translating it literally. I'm being a little more figurative in saying it's not that necessarily every single person stricken with tzara'at is guilty of speaking Lashon Hara, but there is an idea embedded in here that to speak Lashon Hara is to destroy the fabric of society. It's to invite myself to be excluded from the camp because that's the only solution which is possible.
Which is striking because normally we'd think, you know, violence, theft, you know, these are the kind of things that would get somebody excluded. But so you spoke a little disparagingly about somebody and that is the thing that gets you kicked out. Like, what do you make of that? What is the gap between how the sages understood disparaging speech and how we seem to be drowning in it, either in print or online, or even in our casual conversation when we're talking about public leaders, when we're talking about spiritual leaders, when we're talking about our neighbors, we seem to engage in it without thinking twice. What do you make of that gap?
I think that the brilliance of the rabbis in redefining tzara'at as being related to Lashon Hara was that in one stroke, they made explicable the incredible amount of attention that the Torah seems to devote to this condition. The endless amount of verses, because really what the rabbis are saying is, yes, this is a condition which is absolutely prevalent in our society, and it is destructive beyond belief. I think you're right. We're drowning in it in the media, in print, in political discourse. And I mean, we know, I think, we realize, we understand just how destructive it is.
And you could even argue because there's no social consequence, there's no equivalent of shunning or shaming for this kind of behavior, because there's no consequence, it just keeps going and going.
And, you know, the rabbis are alerting us that if there isn't some kind of societal response, it undermines really the fabric of society because it breaks down the trust that allows us to live together and to work together on common projects.
You know, it brings me even to question or think about the whole role of the Kohen, of the priest, right? He's not just there to look at the skin with a magnifying glass and look for spots or hair growth or change in color. I'm hoping he's there also to tell the person, let me explain to you why this might have happened to you, and let's talk about the things that have to happen in order for your behavior to change.
It's a beautiful insight. In other words, you're saying the Kohen is not medical personnel. he's somebody who is a spiritual guide, which is, you know, that is his essential role in sort of the scheme of things in our tradition back in the day, at least.
And here, if this guy wants back into the community, he has to go speak to the spiritual guide to understand, I'm thinking, what has gone wrong and what needs to happen in order to fix it.
It's not a bad idea for some of our politicians, to be perfectly honest.
The question is, who's going to be the Kohen? See, the problem is they all think they're the Kohanim. We have to inform them that, in fact, they're the Mitzuraim, and they need Kohanim themselves. Well, we can take that on when we're done. I want to sort of broaden this discussion out a little bit and speak in general about the project of finding relevance in laws or practices or rituals that at first blush seem to be so far out of our level of understanding. And I guess I want to ask you two things. First of all, do you think there is value in the opposite? In other words, the classic idea of it's a chok, it's a mitzvah without a reason, and I show my allegiance, my fidelity, my commitment to the Torah by doing things that don't make sense, that I can't make sense of. So I want to put that question out there to you. And the second question is, what do you do when you can't find the relevance?
Great questions.
Thank you. That's why I'm here. I don't have great answers, but I can ask the question.
You know, I think that there need not be a contradiction. My motivation for doing whatever it is that I do may very well be my devotion or my allegiance to God. That does not relieve me of the responsibility to use the brain that God gave me in order to try and understand what it is that He wants from me. I mean, I would say, you know, that's certainly the approach of some of the Rishonim, most famously the Rambam, who, you know, basically says as much, or Ibn Ezra, who sort of works in the same direction, where they see tremendous value in using our God-given intellect to try and understand what it is that the Torah wants from us, but with the recognition that at the end of the day, that does not necessarily serve as the motivator for our devotion or our observance. They're sort of two different ideas.
It's not a criteria, according to those views. If I can't figure it out, I'm still bound by the law. What you're saying is trying to figure it out is an essential piece of what it means to study Torah and serve God.
And to be human.
Being human means using my intellect.
Correct. For them.
I guess the piece that I'm thinking about is the relative value. And it's interesting. Most medievals do try to find reasons. They might be mystical reasons as opposed to rational reasons, but the desire to have it fit into a system is very powerful across the board, not just philosophers and rationalists, but the more mystical variety as well. But I'm still wondering if there's a value in seeing these laws as a way to acknowledge my limits, that I can't figure everything out. I live in a world where answers are not always going to be available to me, or solutions aren't always going to be available to me. And part of my awareness and my relationship with God is to sort of accept, or at least occasionally accept, that my understanding is indeed limited.
I think the rabbis, you know, left one or two things unexplored for precisely that reason. Most famously, the Parah Adumah, the red heifer, and sort of its contradictory impact on, you know, those that it renders tahor and those that it renders tameh in its preparation. And, you know, the rabbis like to say that even Shlomo couldn't figure out this one, though he tried.
He did try.
That's basically a way of saying, I think, at least on some sort of, you know, theoretical level, there must be an acknowledgement that we won't understand everything. And that's okay. That's also part of being human. Sometimes I think to myself, I say this to my students as well, we're very ambitious intellectually, and we try to understand everything, and that's wonderful. But if you sort of put it in perspective, we're living on sort of one tiny little planet in a dusty corner of the Milky Way, which is a vast galaxy, but it's just one of billions of other galaxies that are out there. Can I really understand the mind of God in some sort of an ultimate sense? And of course, the answer is no. So there has to be humility. I think it's about cultivating humility as well. It's not just about piety, but it's about recognizing our limits.
And also for me, there's a certain purity of service. I'm using that word purity, but not deliberately, in that I'm doing it even though I can't understand it. It's only an act of service. I don't claim that it has any other positive effect other than to be a gesture or an act of service towards God. And I'm wondering if that also is a piece sometimes of this puzzle that has value.
That resonates for me to some degree, but, you know, when it's pushed to its extreme formulation, I don't find it compelling. That's sort of, you know, the Yeshaya Leibowitz approach to things. That doesn't speak to me so much, although I could understand how it might speak to him. I really feel like our role on this earth is to understand the Torah, understand the human condition, understand as much as we can understand about the world that we live in.
And that our religious behavior has to be a piece of that. It can't be, I think the problem that you're sensing is it's taking religious behavior and putting it in the most detached way possible from our ethics, from our interactions, from our understanding of the world, understanding of ourselves, and just leaving it in this box labeled religious behavior, which has a certain power. What you're saying is that it's taking our Torah and divorcing it from the rest of our human experience.
Yeah, and that's sort of, you know, for me at least, that's a fundamental principle, that the Torah speaks to our human experience and guides it and helps us create it in a constructive way.
I bring this up every podcast, but the inability to understand, I feel like we're experiencing a lot of that today, that we are in a situation as the Jewish people where I think in many ways the only ones who have explanations are the people who really can't stand us, right? They have an explanation. We're where we are right now because we have done bad things and we deserve it. But if we don't go down that road and we don't think we deserve what we've gotten, I'm not saying we're not capable of doing things that are wrong, but the idea that this isn't happening or anti-Semitism isn't happening because we deserve it, it does leave us often in this space of feeling like we're in a world where at least God's plan for us and how we make our way through is on some level not so understandable. I'm wondering if that resonates with you now that we're in these parshiyot that challenge our understanding.
Rav Soloveitchik writes that when Job will ask the question, why do I suffer? And God is not willing to answer that question. That's a question that God doesn't answer. The real question to ask is what? What do I do with it? How do I relate to it? And I think that's a question that we can always be asking. I can't speak for outside of Israel, but speaking for Israel over the last year or so, and, you know, sort of we saw a certain process unfolding before this terrible event took place. It was a process of divisiveness. It was certainly full of Lashon Hara and really an inability on some sort of a political, social level for Jews to work together. And I think that definitely had an impact. And I'm hoping that, and I feel that way now, that we sort of realized that that's not the way forward. So what am I trying to say? I guess what I'm trying to say is suffering is a horrible place to be. The question is, what do we do with it and what do we take away from it?
You know, I think there's a nice analogy just to bring us back before we close to your earlier Torah discussion about Tum'ah and the Mitzorah, that you're not claiming that you now have the final, ultimate explanation about how this whole system works and how it works. So that big why we're not going to get necessarily. But in a way, you're saying, here's what I do with it. Here is how I try to take these laws that challenge me and try to make a connection with them to teach me something and my community something and Am Yisrael something that we need to know about, that we need to deepen, that we need to explore. So even if it's not the ultimate answer, we're now done. There's nothing more to be said about the Mitzvah. There's nothing more to be said about Tum'ah and Torah, but it does offer us a way to get a what out of it. As you said before, the what from the Mitzvah is, how do I talk? How do I speak? How do I communicate? How do I express myself? How do our leaders express themselves? And the same thing even with this idea of Tum'ah. What is human potential about? What are we about? How do we engage our world? And how should we see our role in the world? So I think there's real overlap between your approach to evil in the world and Lahavdil, right, how you are going to engage these parts of the Torah that are not immediately accessible to us.
I mean, I would say that's a Pardes Dvar Torah if I ever heard one. You know, and I think that's something that we aspire to do when we are studying Torah, and we want to translate it into how we're living our lives and how we're impacting on the world and how we can be the best people we can be.
All right, Moshe Hatton, your message is clear. First of all, we're not to give up on these parts of Vayikra, even though they strike us as a bit strange. Secondly, there is deep, profound wisdom in them if we're willing to invest the time to try to unlock it. And finally, that's our job. Our job is not to think we're going to get the final answer, but we are trying to translate Torah into wisdom for our lives all of the time.
As usual, Zvi Hirschfeld, I couldn't have said it better myself.
I think you actually did say it better. I just said it quicker, but you said it better. I got the privilege of summarizing you. So on that note, I think it's a good place for us to finish. As I've said, and at this point, too many times, we record these a few weeks before you hear them. And as we are speaking right now, unfortunately, there are young men, among them young Hatton men, who are out there trying to protect the Jewish people. We are still in a war. Our hostages are still not home safely. And so we are still at a point where we are praying and hoping that by the time you're listening to this, there will be peace and the hostages will be with their families and the world will be a lot better. And if that doesn't happen, then I guess we are praying and asking for the strength and the resilience to maintain and to grow and to keep trying to learn and improve in the face of all of these challenges. Shabbat Shalom, Michael Hatton.
Shabbat Shalom, Zvi.
And
thank
wishing
you.
All of you a Shabbat Shalom as well. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in to the Pardes Parsha podcast, recorded here at Nomi Studios in Jerusalem. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and gained some new insights and perspectives on the Torah portion. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite streaming platform and leave us a 5-star review if you enjoyed the episode. Your feedback helps us reach more people with these important conversations. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to exploring the Torah with you again next week on the Pardes Parsha podcast. Shabbat Shalom.